This is Sciographies, an introduction to people who make Canadian science happen.
I'm David Barkley, co-host and an assistant professor in the Department of Oceanography.
I'm Shauna Bullman, co-host, neuroscience student, and science communication intern.
I'm Nicole Camo, and we're all from Dalhousie University's Faculty of Science. In this episode, we speak with Dr. Sarah Wells. She's the Assistant Dean of the Medical Sciences Program at Dalhousie University and a professor in both the Department of Physics and Atmospheric Sciences and the School of Biomedical Engineering. Sarah tells us about growing up in the small town of Lucan, Ontario, and how the local library helped her discover her passion for figuring out how things work. From an early age, she knew she wanted to be a scientist. Now, she combines physics, engineering, materials science, and physiology to better understand why women say their hearts feel full when they become pregnant. But really, heart valves actually do expand to accommodate 50% more blood coursing through them to support a new organ system during pregnancy. Sarah tells us about that and how finding inspiration in biology and nature can lead to better tissue engineering solutions, medical treatments, and more.
Where did you grow up?
In southern Ontario. I grew up on a horse farm about half an hour outside of London, Ontario.
Okay.
Yeah.
And still a horse person? Were you a horse person at the time?
Yes.
Riding a lot?
Yes.
You never got thrown?
Yes, I did. several accidents, yes.
Okay. Yes. And was it also like a farm, a working farm?
On the property, there were cattle on the property, but the barn was run by a separate farmer. So we were surrounded by cattle fields, mm-hmm. but they were... It's kind of complicated. The farmhouse was attached originally to a cattle barn, and then the two were sold separately. So we lived in the farmhouse, and the cattle barn in behind was run by somebody else. And we had a horse barn on the same property.
Okay. So your parents weren't farmers then?
Well, no, my mother ran the horse stables, and my father was a police detective.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yes.
But this is enough outside of London that it's pretty rural.
Oh yes. So my public school was surrounded by cornfields.
Okay.
Yes, and it's very rural.
How many people in your school would you say?
Oh gosh, a few hundred. The town was called Lucan, and the population at the time was about 1,000.
Okay.
Yes.
And your father's the detective for the town?
No, he was a detective with the Ontario Provincial Police, so like a major crimes detective. So he did much of southern Ontario.
Okay.
So he was in a car a lot, going and interviewing various suspects or whatever. Yeah.
Okay. I was imagining he was solving every single crime in the tiny town of Lucan.
No.
Did you engage much with his work?
Not really. No, he rarely talked about it at the time. And I know there were times when we wouldn't see him for several days, and I would hear about some major crime on the radio. You know, someone had been murdered and someone was missing. Mm-hmm. And I would put two and two together. That's why I haven't seen him in a couple of days.
A little detective work of your own.
Right. But I mean, now that I'm older and he's long retired and talks a little bit about some of the cases he worked on, I'm really amazed at how he seemed so together and calm. I think it takes a certain personality to do that kind of work and not bring it home. I mean, maybe he did bring it home, but we never saw it.
Okay.
So I'm still, to this day, am quite impressed that he was able to do that and still, you know, remain human.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And so the school, the public school you went to, surrounded by cornfields, mm-hmm. was that from kindergarten all the way to grade 12?
Oh, so the, I guess you'd call it a prep school, kindergarten to grade 4 was on the main street of Lucan, which is still...
Can you paint us a picture of what that looks like?
It's, I think there's one set of traffic lights.
Mm-hmm.
it's right across from the Lucan Arena, and there's a few other stores on the main street, but it's a very small town.
Yeah.
And then grade 5 through 8 was outside of the town, so literally surrounded by fields.
Yeah. You're in the schoolhouse surrounded by cornfields until the 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to go to London for high school?
Well, even my high school, Medway High School, is in Arva, Ontario, which was actually, at the time, smaller than Lucan, also surrounded by cornfields, but about maybe under 1,000 students, though. So mostly rural kids, though, coming into Arva for high school. So it meant an hour on the bus almost every morning.
Wow. So how about rural hijinks? What's your childhood looking like? You're riding horses. Obviously, that's a very upstanding hobby.
Mm-hmm.
But what else were you doing?
Were you playing in creeks? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're going out to play in the river.
Yeah.
You know, watch out for the bull. You know, we would just run wild. We had a canoe. We would go down to the Sable River and canoe for the day, go fishing. Lots of playing outside.
Mm-hmm. And so pretty idealistic
childhood. Yes.
But what about into the teenage years? Now you're taking the bus for an hour.
Yeah.
1 hour each way.
Just about, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you're in high school.
Yeah.
1,000 kids, so a little more chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
What's the rural experience like then?
It's pretty isolating, and I talk to university students these days, and they talk about all their extracurricular activities. Mm-hmm. I'm the assistant dean for the medical sciences program, so those students particularly engage in community. Right. And I look back and think, I wouldn't have had any opportunity to do that. I mean, the bus came at 10 after 7 in the morning, and I'd get home at 4 p.m., and, you know, you go out and feed the horses, and, you know, that's it.
Yeah.
There's no opportunity to volunteer at the children's hospital or, you know, these sorts of activities. So it's pretty isolating, but you're still engaged in your own rural community, whether that's, you know, going out and helping your neighbors or helping your parents bale hay for the horses or picking rocks out of a field, whatever. I mean, you're still engaged in your community. It's just not really what I see for a lot of university students today.
Can't put it on your CV. Right, rock picking.
It's not quite as impressive.
It's like other activities, rock picking.
Yeah, I'm really good at bailing hay. Yeah.
So at what point, I mean, did you were going through high school, did you take an academic turn or?
So this is, I can remember back to when I was probably about 10, going to the Lucan Library and checking out every science book that they had several times, because the science section, I still know where it was in the library. And I would check out the same, they're mostly astronomy books, and I would check those out over and over again. And I really caught the science bug early on.
Okay.
And so in high school, that's when I started getting interested in, you know, science as a future career.
So you're reading these astronomy books.
Yeah.
Were you a star expert? Could you?
Oh, I wasn't an expert, but I was very interested. My parents bought me a telescope when I was 12 or 13.
Okay. So they were feeding.
Yes.
They were feeding the beast.
Yes. And and I remember being at a friend's birthday party, probably, I don't know, 10 or 11, and there was going to be a lunar eclipse. And I remember telling them I had to leave the party. I couldn't stay overnight because someone had to take notes about this eclipse. And I had a notebook and I was looking at the eclipse through binoculars and drawing the phases of the eclipse, but as if no one else was going to record this, right?
Just in case.
It was all up to me, this 11-year-old in, you know, rural route to Lucan. I was gonna document this eclipse. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in astronomy for quite a long time. And I think just because the fact that those were the books that were at the Lucan Library, essentially. But there's something I could observe, you know, from our back field.
Mm-hmm.
But then in high school, I started getting interested in physics, biophysics. Mm-hmm. And it was in a grade 11 where I saw an ad for the regional science fair. And the top prize for the London and Regional Science Fair was a summer job at the biophysics department at Western. So September of grade 11, I decided I'm going to enter this science fair. We didn't have to do a science project that year, but that was irrelevant.
Sure.
I thought, I'm doing a science project, and I'm going to work on it the entire year. And I'm going to enter the science fair, and I'm going to win the Lucan Science Fair, and then I'm going to go to the regionals and win that one. And so I did this science project on pollen, and I had my grade 11 biology teacher driving me to the greenhouse at Western, collecting pollen from samples through the winter. And I entered the science fair, and I ended up getting this prize and getting a summer job at biophysics.
Okay. So several of our guests, I feel like on this podcast, could be described with the word precocious. So you're in grade 11,
yeah,
working in a university lab.
Yes.
What's that experience like?
I was so excited. And when I started that summer, I quickly realized they had a large summer student program. Mm-hmm. I was the only high school student. They were mostly undergrads from engineering, physics, and they were medical students.
Yeah.
And they were mostly male.
Okay.
So I was pretty out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
But I was just so excited to be there. It just didn't matter.
Yeah.
And I remember giving it was quite a formal research program where students worked on a project. You gave oral presentations. And mm-hmm. I remember my first oral presentation, very carefully put together, giving this presentation about red blood cell velocity distributions in skeletal muscle. And the first question I had from the audience, so this is the first time I was ever asked a science question. And the person said, have you considered doing a chi-square analysis on your velocity, profiles or your velocity categories? And I just stood there and I started laughing and I said, say that again. What did I do? A what? Chi-square analysis. And I said, I'm in grade 11. I haven't even taken calculus yet. And then so the person who hired me said, oh, I thought you were done high. I thought you were coming into university. I said, no, I'm in grade 11. Oh, I thought you were in grade 13,
right,
we had at the time.
Yeah.
So that's when I realized, wow, I'm really out of my league here. But
amazing.
Whatever, that's, kept going.
Yeah.
Just all you can do is laugh and say, ask me in 4 years.
Yeah. So after that very positive experience,
yeah,
was that sort of you knew you were going to go to Western or
yes,
work in that lab?
Yeah.
Was that, and that's what happened.
Yeah, that was it.
They, real straight shot.
Biophysics department basically helped raise me. So I started there when I just turned 17, I guess, right, mm-hmm, the summer after grade 11. I worked there every summer until the summer before graduate school. So
okay,
7 years.
Wow.
And then I did my undergraduate honors degree in that program too.
Did you know graduate school was going to be the next step? Or
yes,
did you ever consider, you didn't consider anything else?
No.
And none of this, I want to take a year off stuff.
No. Oh God, no. I think the most time I took off was about a month between the end of my PhD and my postdoc.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now that David has uncovered how driven Sarah has always been, we'll move it over to Shauna for the science story.
How long have you been at Dalhousie?
18 years.
Oh my goodness. So probably a lot of research.
Yeah.
And so what did your research look like when you began?
So when I first started, it was mainly focused on developing elastic tissues and elastic mechanisms. So very, very material science. And the model I was looking at was in developing bovine fetuses, so in cattle.
Okay.
I can study developmental tissues without having an animal model in my lab, using a bovine model. So there's abattoirs, slaughterhouses throughout Nova Scotia. You know, they're slaughtering cattle daily for food.
Mm-hmm.
And, their hearts, aortas, ligaments are generally thrown away. So I can use those tissues from cattle of various ages And even cattle are sent to slaughter that happen to be pregnant. Farmers don't know if cattle are pregnant or not when they're sent to slaughter. They usually don't know until they've, you know, finished the slaughter that there happens to be a fetal calf that's obviously no longer alive. I can go in and harvest those tissues from the calf and from the maternal cow, measure the size of the calf, and calculate a gestational age. So this is a way of collecting tissue samples from developing fetuses and from the corresponding mother.
So you're using something that otherwise would have been thrown away.
Exactly, yes.
18 years later, what are you still studying the same thing? Has your interests evolved?
As I went on, I started to become interested in adaptations, not just on the developing fetal side. Lots of research on that. I started getting interested in cardiovascular adaptations in pregnancy on the maternal side. So there's lots of research on the developing fetus, the developing heart and arteries of the fetus, and things that can go wrong in development. The whole developmental origins of adult disease, the idea that problems during fetal development can translate into disease in later life. And in the cardiovascular system, that's usually surrounding, you know, problems in aortic development. Some defect in elastic tissue development in the fetal aorta may translate into hypertension in adulthood.
So it all begins when you're a fetus.
Exactly. So you know, I started off on that side, like the fetal side of the placenta. And then I started wondering about the maternal cardiovascular adaptations or how cardiovascular tissues in the mother respond or adapt to pregnancy, because everyone's looking at fetal development.
Yeah.
And I knew that, you know, the maternal cardiovascular system has to undergo these amazing adaptations to support an entire new organ system. You've got a placenta, 40% of your cardiac output is going to this new organ. And it turns out the maternal cardiovascular adaptations are quite profound. Your blood volume increases by 50%.
Whoa.
Yes. Yes. Most of this happens in the first 8 weeks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So your blood volume increases, your cardiac output increases, and not a lot is known about how the cardiovascular system adapts to that.
We just know that it does.
We just know that it does. And there's, you know, cardiologists are aware that the maternal heart gets larger, the aorta gets wider, and that's about it.
Oh, wow. There's a big gap in the research.
And so this is what I was thinking is, well, how exactly, you know, everyone's focusing on fetal developmental remodeling. Of course, as the fetus develops, the blood pressure gradually rises, and that triggers the proper deposition of tissues in the cardiovascular system. But take an adult cardiovascular system, fully developed, and you suddenly increase blood volume by 50%. What are the mechanical, what are the biomechanical adaptations to that? Nobody had looked at it. So my next discovery grant was biomechanical adaptations of maternal cardiovascular tissues. And have focused on aorta, pericardium, and heart valves, and have shown that all of those tissues undergo incredible remodeling in this short 9-month period. And it's a remodeling that doesn't look anything like what you see in pathological conditions like hypertension. So the aorta remodels in pregnancy, but not in a way that looks like hypertension.
And so when you say pathological, that is when something goes wrong.
Yes. So, we know mature cardiovascular tissues will remodel, adjust their structure in pathological conditions. When you have hypertension, blood vessel walls thicken, the wall becomes stiffer. If you're in heart failure, your heart valves will remodel pathologically. They ends up the valves become stiffer, they tear, and eventually need to be replaced.
Right, yeah.
And what I thought was interesting was in pregnancy, you have a volume loading, that, you know, sudden volume increase in the in blood volume. Your heart has to expand to accommodate this. Well, that's the exact same thing that happens in heart failure. Volume overload in pregnancy is almost exactly like volume overload in heart failure. And valves in heart failure often have to be replaced.
But not for the moms.
But not. So this is where I thought, I wonder what the heart valves are doing in pregnancy.
Right.
And so I was at the World Biomaterials Congress. I remember this so clearly back in, it was the early 2000s. And I was at the heart valve session, and there was an argument about whether tissue engineered heart valves, you know, if we grow heart valve replacements in petri dish, essentially, do those tissues have to have a capacity to remodel, mm-hmm. to adjust their structure under altered loading conditions? And about half the audience thought yes, and half the audience thought no. And I thought, there's no reason that heart valves should be exempt from this idea that tissues remodel to mechanical loads.
Mm-hmm.
We know bone does it, we do, muscles do it, arteries do it. Why shouldn't heart valves? So I said at the time, I remember talking to one of my colleagues, it was actually my postdoc supervisor, I said, someone needs to look at heart valves in the maternal heart during pregnancy to see if there's physiological remodeling. And I remember him saying, oh, yeah, you probably wouldn't see anything, especially in the mitral valve, because the anatomy of the mitral valve is so, there's so much variation in it from from person to person. If there was any adjustments in the structure, you'd never be able to detect it.
It wouldn't be consistent.
Well, I came back to Nova Scotia and started collecting mitral valves.
The fire.
I am on this. And it turns out that the heart valves undergo this incredibly dramatic remodeling. The mitral valve increases its area by 50%. The aortic valve leaflets almost double in area. And the remodeling is this beautiful, enlarged heart valve leaflet that's beautifully adapted to this volume overload that for some reason does not happen in heart failure. So my work has really gone on to understanding the physiology of this. What are the mechanisms of this physiological adaptation in the maternal heart? If we can figure out what those mechanisms are, maybe that could translate into some type of therapy for valves in heart failure or other cardiac pathologies.
So you've really looked at both sides of the pregnancy, fetus and mother. And so you want to use something that naturally occurs to try and help a pathological disease or disorder?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And this is one of the advantages of being in a multidisciplinary field, because I've got some engineering, I've got some materials engineering, but I've got some fetal maternal medicine. And, you know, when I attend tissue engineering sessions at conferences, they're so focused on, you know, tissue engineering. The whole idea is to recapitulate a tissue in vitro and implant it into a patient. And that's difficult for load-bearing tissues because they have to have the mechanical properties to sustain mechanical loads like a heart valve. And the tissue engineers spent so much time looking in their petri dishes. How do we tell the cells to attach to the collagen? You know, what signals do we need to sort of put a little bit of A and B in and mix it? How do the cells respond? And my view is, if you want to understand tissue engineering, go to fetal developmental physiology, because you need to understand those developmental mechanisms from that are naturally occurring, you know, in the developing fetus. Understand those mechanisms first, then try to recapitulate that in these tissue engineering initiatives.
So it sounds like tissue engineers are trying to sort of reinvent the wheel, but you're saying,
understand the wheel.
Yeah, it already exists. We need to know how to recreate it.
Exactly.
And so what other natural processes are used sort of for the creative process or the research process?
I think this goes back to my preference to look at the natural world to find solutions for medicine and engineering. So if we want to solve problems with tissue engineering, we look at fetal developmental physiology. if we want to understand ways to treat cardiovascular pathologies in adults, we look at how the maternal cardiovascular system adapts to things like pregnancy, understanding the physiological adaptations. On a more general level, I think, you know, my PhD is in materials engineering, and engineers are spending a lot of time trying to develop high performance materials, whether that be for they need specific biocompatibility, they need particular mechanical properties, materials that have, for instance, very high strength, high stiffness, or high resilience, capabilities of absorbing lots of energy. So materials that you would develop for ballistic protection, like a bulletproof vest, things like that. Lots of research has gone into developing those types of engineered materials, but in the end, we still can't produce high performance materials that get close to performing like natural biopolymers.
So the earth does it better.
Yes, basically. I mean, and you know, it's had however many hundreds of millions of years to develop this. But, you know, if we want to look at a high performance tensile material, collagen outperforms steel. It's as strong as steel and 100 times tougher than steel. It can absorb 100 times more energy before failing. Spider silk is even more, basically is capable of absorbing more energy than that. Then Kevlar, you think of a Kevlar bulletproof vest. Well, if you could make a spider silk bulletproof vest, that would perform probably 10 times better. And so it's understanding how these natural materials are engineered, how they're designed. I think that's going to be the key to developing high performance engineering materials. Basically, biomimicry, mimicking what biology has been doing for millions of years. And we need to understand these natural materials first if we want to be able to develop these high performance engineering materials. The answer is going to be biology.
I hope you enjoyed the interview today, despite us having to change it around like three times with you. I'm so sorry about that.
That's no problem. Thanks very much for having me.
But we were really, really happy to have you in. So
thank you.
Okay, thanks so much. Thanks for listening. This has been another episode of Sciographies. If you want to learn more about this episode or others like it, please visit dal.ca/sciographies. This episode was produced by Nicole Comeau and co-hosted by David Barkley and myself, Shauna Bullman. Finally, a special thanks to our guest, Sarah Wells.